When I was a kid, there was something in my household, maybe similar to yours, that was a really big deal. Something that so much time and emphasis went behind. For some of you, you know this one really big thing as the salvation prayer, but when you were a kid, you simply knew it as like inviting Jesus into your heart. And I still look back on my childhood and remember so many nights right before bedtime with my mom, like sitting down doing a devotion and having discussion and prayer around saying this prayer in my life. And if you're anything like me, all of that emphasis behind this one prayer and the importance behind it simply led to this, that throughout my childhood, I prayed that prayer a lot, y'all. And some of you would chalk that up to like, I was just a bad kid. But for me, it was like a security blanket. It was like, all right, I made another mistake. I think I better say that again just to make sure that I'm covered. Or we went off to camp, and it was like, I'm not so sure I got it right the first time. So just so I'm certain, I'm going to make sure I get it right the second time or the 42nd time in my life. And then you grow up and you become a parent, and you reciprocate the process with your own kids. That you become a parent, and if you're anything like me, it's like I feel like there's two primary responsibilities for me as a parent before I send my kids out into the world. Number one, make sure that they can read. Number two, make sure that they accept Jesus. And once we do those two things, we can kind of wipe our hands clean and our kids are good to go. We've done our job. And yet the whole goal when I look back at my childhood behind this thing that was such a big deal was the whole premise was about entering in. It was about entering into some place someday. It was about entering into heaven someday. And don't get me wrong, there's nothing wrong with that or bad about that. In fact, it's an incredibly good thing, and it's a decision that never once in my life have I regretted making. And yet as we journey through our lives following Christ and acting as Christians, oftentimes it can become so easy for us to reduce following Jesus down to just entering into something someday. And yet what if there was incredible danger in reducing following Christ down to simply that? Because I think when we go back 2,000 years ago to the very first Christmas and we read about Jesus and what happened in the aftermath of that very first Christmas, what we find is this, is that in following Jesus, there is just as much importance in participating in something right now as there is in entering into someplace someday. You see, 2,000 years ago, we begin to see a story take place. A story that rewrites our own stories. Because when we reduce Jesus and the story of Christmas and what happens in the aftermath to simply a ticket to enter into something, what we miss is that slowly along the way we have simply turned into believers instead of participators. But 2,000 years ago, that didn't seem to be an option on the table. Because there wasn't just a baby being born in Bethlehem. Not just a baby to believe in, there was a king stepping into this world. And the choice that some people made 2,000 years ago to become participators in following this new king, this new upside-down kingdom that was being introduced to our world, is part of the very reason why we still celebrate Christmas today. You see, we're right smack dab in the middle of this series that we are calling The Day After Christmas. And throughout this entire series, we're looking at the many reasons why Christmas is so special and nostalgic to so many of us. A season full of tradition and incredible memories. And yet a season that for some, if not all of us, also carries a certain amount of baggage with it. That as we look at our Christmas season, some of y'all can relate to this. It's also a season that, while filled with incredible tradition and memories, also comes with a certain amount of stress and chaos in our lives. So much so that for some of us, by the time we get through Christmas Day and we reach the day after Christmas, we are just begging for some sense of normal in our lives. That we're hoping that as quick as possible we can put the chaos and the stress of Christmas behind us and things can just go back to normal again. And ironically, 2,000 years ago, on the day after that very first Christmas, people throughout the entire world were experiencing that exact same feeling. There was this desire, like never before in the entire world, for things to go back to normal again. And the reason that the entire world was craving normal in their lives is because 2,000 years ago, there was no such thing as Christmas. 2,000 years ago, there was simply chaos. Chaos that fell upon the world on the back of a decision by Caesar Augustus. And the decision was this: that in those days, Caesar Augustus issued a decree. A decree that a census should be taken of the entire Roman world. The entire world was called to report back to the town of their birth and to report to the government that they were still alive, how much money they were making, and then, shocker of them all, what we still hate 2,000 years later, how much taxes were due and to be paid by each individual. And you can imagine that in the aftermath of this decision, that as each family returned back to the town of their birth, that their travel 2,000 years ago was full of a whole lot of danger and expense and inconvenience to their lives. And they were craving that things in their life for their family would simply go back to normal as quickly as possible. And yet in the aftermath of that very first Christmas, in the middle of all of that chaos, what was happening in the middle of it all was that a king was being secreted into the world. A baby was born in the unlikeliest of places, in the middle of a cave, in the middle of lowly Bethlehem, that would introduce an upside-down kingdom into this world that would be unlike the kingdom that we live in, unlike the world that we presently reside in, because it would begin to introduce and bring to the table things like others firsting and elevating the least of these. A kingdom that was for this world, but not like this world. A kingdom that was in this world, but not of this world. And yet with this king, what was so absolutely incredible is that the longevity of his reign was unlike anything the world had ever seen before. Because his kingship wouldn't be determined by winning wars. His legacy wouldn't be left by his kingship being passed down amongst his offspring. No, it was made very clear that before this baby was born in Bethlehem, that his kingship and his kingdom would look unlike anything the world had ever seen before. Because what was communicated to his mother was this: and his kingdom will last forever. His reign will never end. And this king, who has been secreted into the world, is here to stay. Yes, 2,000 years later, this king is still here. And this brilliant plan to secret a king with an upside-down kingdom into the world that would change everything, to secret him into the world would have worked to absolute perfection if not for a few lost and confused magi. Three court advisors who got lost in following the star, in seeking out this baby, this king that had been secreted into the world, in an attempt to find him and worship him in the aftermath of that very first Christmas. And what initially turned the world upside down was that these three lost and confused magi unveiled this incredible plan to the unlikeliest of sources. Dare I say, an unfavorable source, in the form of the reigning king, King Herod the Great. And last week, we began this story by moving through the initial telling, the initial account by a guy named Matthew, one of Jesus' very disciples who had witnessed this and been told about this story through eyewitnesses. You see, this isn't just a story in a book. This is something that actually happened 2,000 years ago. And what we find at the very beginning of this story is some context that allows us to see Christmas. And not just what it meant 2,000 years ago, but what it means now in the aftermath, the day after Christmas and every day since, in each and every one of our lives. You see, here is what we looked at last week. Starting in Matthew chapter 2, verse 1, the story begins like this. Jesus was born in Bethlehem in Judea during the reign of King Herod. About that time, some wise men from the eastern lands arrived in Jerusalem asking, "Where is the newborn king of the Jews? We saw his star as it rose, and we have come to worship him." Now, if you weren't here last week, I want to put you on equal footing with everybody else and burst your Christmas song bubble in about 2 seconds. You see, that creative, incredible song that we've sung throughout our entire lives, We Three Kings, is actually not accurate at all, because these three dudes weren't kings at all. They were simply court advisors. They were magi. And these guys weren't actually very good at following the star. How do we know that? Because if they were actually following the star, they wouldn't have ended up in Herod's palace in Jerusalem, because that's not where the star was leading them. And yet here we find these three guys stumble their way into King Herod's palace asking a question that changed everything. Where is this new king that has been born? Can you imagine asking that question in front of the reigning king? A king who had an incredible legacy, and as with every king during that time, had a desire that his kingship and his legacy would be passed on to his offspring, his own children. And here come these three dudes walking into the middle of the palace saying, hey, we're looking for the new king. Have you seen him? Do you know where he's at? And when they asked this question, King Herod was deeply disturbed, as was everyone in Jerusalem. King Herod was disturbed because here, in an instant, there was a threat to his rule. A threat to his reign, a threat to his legacy. But then, if you're anything like me, you see the second part of that and you get kind of confused, right? Like, why was everybody else in Jerusalem disturbed? I don't get it. God had been silent for 400 years. They had been waiting on this Messiah who had been foretold for like thousands of years. And suddenly, springing onto the pages of history seems like an answer to their prayers. And yet everyone's disturbed. Why? Because every person in Jerusalem and surrounding Jerusalem knew this. When two kings inhabit the same place, insurrection is all but certain. An uprising would take place. An uprising that would throw a wrench into their lives and their safety and their comfort levels and the life they had hoped for and dreamt for. That their lives would now be full of turmoil and insecurity from that day forward. And so everybody was disturbed. And yet in the aftermath of that disturbance, King Herod calls a meeting and asks a question that reveals something so ridiculously incredible about who this baby actually was. He called a meeting of the leading priests and teachers of the religious law and asked, where is the, and the Greek word here in the original writing was Christos. A Greek word that is literally defined as God's anointed one, God's final king, the king. Where is the king? Where is the Messiah supposed to be born? And last week, as we looked at those first four verses of this passage, we really underscored the meaning behind Herod's nickname. You see, Herod was known as Herod the Great. And the reason that he got that nickname is because Herod literally was great. He was an incredibly powerful and successful king. King Herod was a brilliant architect, credited with building some of the most fascinating and incredible structures throughout Jerusalem and the land surrounding it. But on top of that, King Herod was also known as an absolutely brilliant military strategist. He was one of the most incredibly talented generals who had ever risen up to power in that land of all time. And King Herod, on top of all of those incredible attributes, as with any king, possessed incredible wealth and incredible power. And yet what we also know about King Herod is this, is that with this incredible power and this incredible wealth and these incredible skills, King Herod was building an incredible legacy of his kingship. And within that legacy, his one desire was that his legacy would continue on by being passed on to his kids. And his kids would become king, and his grandkids would become king, and his great-grandkids would become king. And everybody would continue to reference back to this lineage of great kings, starting with Herod the Great. And that is what he wanted to be known at. And yet what we didn't review last week was this, and this is so incredible, y'all. What we also know about King Herod the Great, to give you some historical context, is that King Herod also assimilated himself into the Jewish faith. So much so that King Herod was the one responsible for rebuilding the temple in Jerusalem. Sometimes the temple in Jerusalem is literally referred to as Herod's temple because he is the one that resurrected the temple the second time and rebuilt it. King Herod was okay with all of the rituals of the Jewish faith. He was good with going to the temple and offering sacrifices, good with going to the temple and encountering this Jewish God called Yahweh. All of these things were copacetic with Herod, and he had even joined in on some of them, to the point where Herod was good with all of these Jewish things and all of these rituals and all of these Jewish laws, as long as they benefited or remained indifferent to his legacy. But the moment there was a threat, Herod knew he had to spring into action, because two kings could not coexist. And in the aftermath of these wise men looking for the birth of this newborn king who had been secreted into the world, Herod immediately feels threatened, and rightly so, and knows he must extinguish this threat to his throne and his legacy. And so he immediately goes to work. In verse 5, it continues. When he asked the question, where is this Christos to be born? Where is the king, the Messiah, to be born? The Magi respond, in Bethlehem, in Judea, they said. For this is what the prophet wrote. And here were these three Magi who weren't exactly affiliated with the Jewish faith, who reach back into history and pull something out that Micah had written almost 500 years to the previous. They pull out what this prophet had written, what it said about this baby named Jesus. And you, O Bethlehem, in the land of Judah, are not the least among the ruling cities of Judah. For a ruler, a king, will come from you, who will be the shepherd for my people Israel. Then Herod called for a private meeting with the wise men, and he learned from them the time when the star had first appeared. Then he told them, go to Bethlehem and search carefully for the child, and when you find him, just come back to me and report to me where he is, so that I can go and worship him too. And this is the part of the story that is absolutely laughable, y'all. So much so that these three strangers could see right through it. What they recognized is that Herod the Great, while copacetic with all the Jewish rituals and assimilating himself into the Jewish faith, as long as it didn't infringe upon his own legacy, his own power, his own wealth, his own rulership, was good with all of that. But they knew that the moment things shifted and another king entered onto the scene proposing a totally different kingdom, there was no way that King Herod the Great was bowing his knee to another man. There's no way King Herod was submitting to another king on this earth. And so the story continues. After this interview, the wise men went their way, and the star they had seen in the east guided them to Bethlehem. It went ahead of them and stopped over the place where the child was. When they saw the star, they were filled with joy. Hang on, y'all. I bursted some Christmas song bubble last week. I'm going to do the same this week, okay? Sorry. They entered the house? Wait a second. Come on, y'all. I got the nativity scene sitting in my living room with the wise men and their camels and the three chests strapped onto the camel's back that tells me the wise men were there at the manger. They came and visited Jesus in the direct aftermath. That's actually not what happened. Seeing all the confusion and all the chaos that surrounded that very first Christmas in their searching for this newborn king who had been secreted into the world, because this brilliant plan of secreting a king in the world had been pulled off to almost perfection, it took them some time to find this baby Jesus as well. And so instead of visiting Jesus in the manger, Mary and Joseph had Jesus in that cave in Bethlehem, and then what did they do? They took Jesus back, most likely to Nazareth, to their home. And there he grew up 3 months, 6 months, some scholars believe even a year into his birth before these three wise guys showed up at his house, knocked on the door, walked into the living room, and finally got an opportunity to drop their frankincense and gold and myrrh at the feet of this baby Jesus. You see, this is what's actually happening. They entered the house and they saw the child there with his mother. And they bowed down and worshiped him. Then they opened their treasure chest and gave him gifts of gold, frankincense, and myrrh. When it was time to leave, they returned to their own country by another route. This is how we know. The three wise men could see through the lies of Herod. There ain't no way he's going to worship this baby Jesus, right? There ain't no way he's bowing his knee to another king that threatens his rulership. And so they leave for their own country by another route, for God had warned them in a dream not to return to Herod. After the wise men were gone, an angel of the Lord appeared to Joseph in a dream. "Get up, flee to Egypt with the child and his mother," the angel said. "Stay there until I tell you to return, because Herod is going to search for the child to kill him." And if you're anything like me, this is the part of the Christmas story in which I ask the question, why? Why, in the middle of a picture that I want to continue to see through the lens of Away in a Manger and Silent Night, did such a mess have to be introduced right into the middle of it all? Such hatred and cruelty and violence and vengeance. The reason? Because this part of the story paints a perfect picture for you and I of the world that this king was being secreted into. A world that was a mess, full of me first. A world that was a mess, full of elevating myself at the expense of somebody else. A world that was a mess, full of sin, the sin of humanity. And this moment in time reveals something so incredible, something so real and so relevant for you and I 2,000 years later, that sprung to relevance on the day after Christmas and still holds just as much power and relevance in your story and in my story right here and right now today. See, this moment officially shows us the reality that in an instant, there were two different kingdoms colliding that would be in conflict with one another. Two kingdoms that would be polar opposites of one another. A kingdom that was upside down, being secreted into the world on the back of a king. A king who would lay down his life for his subjects, that would collide with a world that was centered on things like this. In verse 16, Herod was furious when he realized that the wise men had outwitted him. And so what did he do? To exterminate the very person who is threatening his kingship and his legacy, he sent soldiers to kill all the boys in and around Bethlehem who were 2 years old and under, based upon the wise men's report of the star's first appearance. He sent his soldiers to kill every baby boy around the entire region surrounding Bethlehem who were 2 years old or younger. But by putting on flesh and coming into this world, this king who had been secreted into the middle of a kingdom that his own kingdom would collide with and be in conflict with, this king set a precedent for our faith that we often struggle with. And it was this: our faith does not require us to look away from cruelty, injustice, and suffering in our world. Our faith has never required us to look away from things like cruelty and injustice and suffering within our world. And so often it's become easy for us to begin to believe or buy into what everybody else is thinking and the questions that everybody else has that makes us believe that a broken world explains away a good and loving God. When in essence, Christmas proves the exact opposite. We live in a broken world, not because of God, because of me. Because of my own sin and the sin of humanity. It wasn't God's choice. It wasn't his design for our world and the kingdom in which we live in to be full of cruelty and injustices and suffering. That was never his design. That was never his choice. But he was a God who loved us enough to allow us to make our own choice. And do you know what my choice has been over and over and over again that ultimately ushered in a kingdom full of cruelty and injustice and suffering? I've got this on my own. I know best for me, and I'll choose my own way. And on the back of that choice, a mess was introduced into our world. And yet, despite our choices making this world broken, God decided to put on flesh and to step right into the middle of our brokenness. But maybe even more incredible than that, not only did he put on flesh and decide to step right into the middle of the messes and the brokenness of this world, he also decided to put on flesh and oftentimes to become the target of that mess and brokenness within our world and within our kingdom. But in the aftermath of being the target of cruelty and injustice and the hatred of this kingdom, he made a decision to become a participator in bringing about a solution to all of those things within our lives and with our world. And in turn, he extended an invitation to you and to me to become a participator in the aftermath as well. Our faith doesn't require us to look away from the messes of this world. In fact, it requires the exact opposite, y'all. Our faith requires us to dive smack dab into the middle of the messes of our world, just like our king did. His kingdom requires us to not be scared away by the cruelty and the injustices, but to see ourselves as participators in bringing about a solution that he offered for the world around us, for our family around us, for our friends around us, for our workplace around us, for our neighborhood around us, for our city around us, for our world around us. But here's the crazy part, y'all. He extended an invitation, but the choice was ours. Which kingdom will we choose to participate in? Which king will we declare our own? You see, last week we introduced this tension that Herod knew, but we often miss, and it was this. Is that when a king is born, people must choose. And yet, what choice are we choosing between? What are the two things that we are choosing between when a second king and a second kingdom was secreted into this world, was introduced right into the middle of a kingdom in which it would be in conflict with? You see, on that day after the very first Christmas, a conflict of epic proportion was introduced, but it was a conflict that wouldn't necessarily surface itself frequently externally. No, it would be a conflict more of internal proportions. A choice between the kingdom of this world and the kingdom for this world. And Herod perfectly personified the kingdom of this world. This kingdom that we all feel tug at us, ironically so, maybe more so during this particular season of the year. That around Christmas, for almost every single one of us, we feel this tug from the kingdom of this world sucking us in to everything that's happening around us and the stress and the chaos. It's a kingdom that's about me first. I want to be in control. And I'll do things that are only concerned with making me better. My decisions are all about my social standing and my financial standing and the way in which people look at me and see me through social media or elsewise. It's a kingdom that centers on me elevating myself, even if it means chopping others down. A kingdom that believes I become higher if I push everybody else beneath me. It's a kingdom that centers on us believing that I'm the king of my life and I'm not surrendering anything to anyone else. It was a kingdom defined by pride. A kingdom that made it clear I don't want to do anything outside of my comfort zone, especially if it cost me something, and especially if it's not a direct return for me and my life and my future. It's a kingdom that's defined by life being all about my consumption. But in conflict with that was this new kingdom that was introduced that was a kingdom for this world. A kingdom that was about others first. A kingdom that started with a sacrifice of the king for his subjects and expected a trickle-down effect of those subjects who had received the sacrifice of the king to in turn make sacrifices for others around them. It was about surrendering your life to a king who knew more and better than you and yet wanted what was best for your life and your future. It was about becoming more by becoming less and elevating other people. It required taking risks to be a part of changing the world around us. It was a kingdom that required action. A kingdom that required active humility every single day. A kingdom that was based on a foundation that we would only make an impact when we were willing to become participators, not simply believers, not consumers, not watchers. Because in the first century, in the aftermath of that first Christmas, what we see immediately happening is that the world was being changed on the back of this new kingdom that was secreted in this world. The world was being changed on the back of people who were choosing to participate in a kingdom that was introduced into this world based upon the fact that a king came and laid his life down so the mistakes of my past could be wiped away. And the baggage that came along with it of shame and guilt didn't have to grip me. And yet what we find is that the world wasn't being changed on the back of the people who had been forgiven. The forgiven weren't changing the world. Hang on, y'all. The forgivers were changing the world. The people who weren't seeing the gift that had been given to them by their king of this new kingdom as simply something that they were meant to be the recipient of, but they viewed this gift from their king as something they had an opportunity to not just receive, but also in turn to take into the world around them. For them to be participants in something that John described so incredibly accurately when he wrote this. One of Jesus' disciples, John, writes one of the four accounts that we see of Jesus' life. And what we know about John is that his purpose in writing his gospel was different than the other three. Because John had an eye for, I want to tell people why. I don't just want to tell people what. I want people to understand the why. Exactly what was happening and what it meant for people's life. And this was the very same guy who last week we read this passage, right? The word became flesh. And made his dwelling among us. You know what he's saying? God put on flesh and he came to earth to make his home here. That very same guy wrote this so absolutely eloquently. The word, Jesus, King Jesus, gave life to everything that was created. And his life brought light to everyone. The light shines in the darkness. And the darkness can never extinguish it. We get to choose to be participators in this happening for the world around us. In the midst of the darkness of cruelty and injustice and suffering. We get a choice to be a part of a kingdom that invites us to be participators in bringing light into the middle of those dark situations and circumstances. We get to choose whether to switch out our kingdom of this world for an incredible kingdom for this world. But doing so requires us to fully understand this. Following this king requires us to trade the consumption mentality of this kingdom for the participant mentality of his kingdom. Following this king who had been secreted into this world requires us to trade the consumption mentality of this world for the participant mentality of his kingdom. When a king is born, people must choose. Is your life, your Christmas season, all about the consumer mentality of this world? It's about me first all the time. It's about my pride, my control, my elevation. Or are you anything like me? You're ready for a switch. You're ready for something different this Christmas season. You're ready for your kids to see something different in you and from you this Christmas season. To follow a king who's inviting you to participate, inviting you to jump in and do something and actually make an impact. But King Herod made it clear 2,000 years ago. These two kingdoms can't both hold the throne in your life. It doesn't work that way. They cannot coexist and both be the king that you choose to follow. These two kingdoms are at conflict within every single one of us. So the question is this: which will you choose? This Christmas, which kingdom will you choose? Let me finish here. You see, when I look back on my life, my past, what I recognize is that there are far too many times to count in which I actually don't fall on one extreme or the other, in which I've made my choice to be a part of the comfort zone that lies somewhere in the middle. And I kind of like the security of just simply being able to be a believer and all the benefits that come along with entering into something someday. That don't pull me out of my comfort zone. And to just stay right here where it's safe. And stay right here where I don't have to do a whole lot. And stay right here where I don't have to take a whole lot of risk. And yet in our lives, when we choose the middle ground of just simply being a believer and reserving ourselves, I like all the benefits that come with just knowing I can enter into something someday, but not really participate in anything right now for the sake of the world around me. It's just as bad as if we choose the other side of the line. Y'all okay? Because what we miss, y'all, is this. The king who was secreted into the world 2,000 years ago was inviting us to participate in an upside-down kingdom because he knew that when we became participators in that, not just would the world around us be impacted and changed, but so too would you and your story. But it will never happen when we reserve ourselves to just being believers. We reserve ourselves to continuing to make the kingdom of this world the king that we're following. It requires us to have the courage to make a change. And so let me pose the question one last time. This Christmas, which kingdom will you choose? You have an invitation. Participate, to get involved, to do something. make a difference, to find significance and purpose in your future. But do we have the courage to choose that? Would you pray with me? Father, this morning, God, I know when I look back at my life and my story, there are so many instances in which I have simply chosen the middle ground to not really be a participator in your kingdom for this world, but to play it safe, to stay in my comfort zone, to feel the security of simply the benefit of entering into something someday. But God, on the day after Christmas 2,000 years ago, that wasn't even an option. There was no middle ground. There was a choice that was presented. When a king is born, people must choose. So God, on this day, I want to have the courage choose to be a participator in your kingdom, to do something, to get involved, to step outside of my comfort zone, to become less by making other people more, to give of myself, of my time, and my resources, to actually make a difference in this world, not just to feel safe, not just to be like everybody else, but to be what everybody else needs from me. God, this Christmas, may we see that a choice has been offered, and may we be courageous enough to make our choice.